but any warrior who raises his sword against the innocent from now on becomes my enemy." He stopped in front of one of the proud warriors until that man worked up the courage to look Ashok in his cold, dark eyes. "Those, I will show as much mercy as they have given to the castless." That warrior looked down. When he got to the end of the line, the officer he'd crippled was sitting in the dirt, hand wrapped in a bloody rag. He looked like he'd spent the rest of the night weeping. "Warn your Thakur that if he continues to harm these castless, I will come for him personally, and visit carnage upon his house in measure equal to that which he has bestowed upon them. Now, go and tell him." The Rizaldar actually seemed baffled by that sudden command.
"But you've left us no rations. We'll starve."
"You can graze like the sheep you are."
"You took our horses, took our boots even. You expect me to hop on one bare foot all the way to the great house?"
"If your men respect you, they will carry you.
Unless you are the incompetent coward I suspect you to be, then they'll leave you for the buzzards and tell their rescuers you perished by my hand."
As he said that, he looked back toward the brave ones, and from the subtle glance they shared, he bet this Rizaldar would be dead the instant the sons were out of sight. Ashok went back to the middle of the line.
"As honorable warriors, you are obligated to obey the law. I understand the difficult position this places you in. I have no easy answer for you. Start walking."
Most of the warriors did. A few, it took a moment for the reality of their situation to sink in. One, who'd been bashed over the head by a club, must have been having a hard time thinking at all, because he didn't move until he got shoved by a surly hunter. One warrior grudgingly helped up their officer. There were two warriors of Akashan, among the sons of the Black Sword, who had participated in the night's raid. Their uniforms were faded and worn thin after wintering in the swamp, but Ashok had asked them to wear them still. He'd wanted the prisoners to see that there were men of their house and caste among their enemies. Let them worry about how many more there might be. One of the Akashani sons had covered his head with a scarf, hiding his features in case he might be recognized, because he still had family in these lands and didn't want them to be held accountable for his crimes. But the other was an orphan, siblings dead of a plague. With no loved ones left to be tortured by the Inquisition, he stood there, proud, as his former brothers marched past.
"Traitor!" the officer snarled. "You abandoned your gods and licked the capital's boots, butchering unarmed women on behalf of the Inquisition, while the sons of the Black Sword have battled wizards and demons and won! Which of us is the real traitor?" "There's no such thing as gods, you fool. What's your name, boy, so I can sic the masks on you?" "Ongud Kedekar Dar Akashan. And I no longer fear your law, you son of a whore."
The young warrior raised his voice so all the prisoners could hear.
"Heed me, brothers. The Forgotten has returned. I've heard his voice. I've seen his might. We are the sons of the Black Sword. You can either join our cause or stay out of the way. If you don't, Ashok Vidal will end you all."
Ashok scowled. He would have to say something to the men about using his name in such a manner. It was one thing to kill the enemies of Thera's god, but it was another thing to be used as a recruiting tool for him. As he watched the defeated depart, Ashok was joined by his two junior officers.
"We should have killed them all when we had the chance," Shekhar muttered.
"Perhaps." That had been his initial inclination. Ashok wasn't used to explaining himself to anyone, but if he was killed, then it would fall on them to finish the mission. Yet Thera wished for this house to taste fear. By the time these survivors are found crossing this sea of grass, they'll be sunburned, dehydrated, with feet blistered and bleeding. Let these proud warriors be seen made into pathetic wretches.
And even with that, they'll be seen as the lucky ones, Eklavya chuckled. Assuming they don't come across a castless mob they've chased from their quarters along the way, because then they'll never be seen or heard from again.
I've no love for the non-people, Shekhar spit on the ground. But that would be a downright poetic end for this bunch, getting their throats cut by fish-eaters.
Eklavya gaped at him. How can you insult the chosen people? The Keeper of Names had declared the Castless to be the true descendants of mighty Ramroan. They're the ones who'll eventually defeat all the demons.
Then they'd better step up and start acting the part, bunch of weak-armed cowards. I'll gut whoever the general says needs gutting, but if we're to bleed for the fish-eaters, they'd better be willing to bleed for themselves.
One of the prophecies says that when the time comes, the Forgotten will deliver weapons into their hands, sufficient to overthrow the capital.
Enough, Ashok said.
Keeta and Thera could hammer out their doctrine and leave him out of it. He had no time for legends of heroes falling from the sky when there was work to be done.
We'll take their horses, but leave a few hunters to guard the captured supplies and pack animals until the main column catches up. We've work to do.
Where to next, General?
He was no tactician. Protectors normally worked alone or in small units, and even when they were functioning as part of a larger force, they usually roamed about doing whatever they felt like. Yet he recalled the lessons of Swordmaster Ratul.
The best time to inflict damage upon your opponent is before he knows you are there.
An army was bigger, but the principle remained the same. The Inquisitor's orders had been left in the Rizaldar's tent. Ashok had read them and studied the map. On the afternoon of the 28th of Palunga, today's date, three pauldrons were to converge on the slums of Dakantar. It was one of the bigger towns in the region, with a large castless quarter that had grown up around their coal mines. Since it was notorious for harbouring rebels, the warriors had wanted to surround and then strike with overwhelming force. This Paltan would not be arriving, but that left two more to be dealt with. The sons had marched all day, then run until midnight to catch up with these warriors. They were tired and would be outnumbered 3-1, but they wouldn't have an opportunity like this again.
We ride for Dakantar.
Chapter 10. They crested the eastern rise and found the town of Dakantar spread across the valley floor below them. Ashok signaled for a halt so the rest could catch up. Most of them were from the warrior caste and were fine riders. However, those from the worker caste had been abused by the pace, and the poor swamp hunters had never been on a horse before. For them, the morning had been a terrible experience atop unfamiliar beasts. Toromana had already fallen off his mount twice. The castless quarter was easy to pick out. It was the shanty town on the north side of the valley. It had sprung up below the gaping holes in the hillside that had to be the coal mines. Luckily, they'd made good time, so the quarter wasn't on fire yet. Between the castless quarter and the town itself was a bustling worker district of factories and brick buildings whose purpose was a mystery to Ashok. Smoke belched from tall stacks as the workers went about their industrious tasks. On the west side of the valley was a warrior's camp, only it was far bigger than the one they'd just raided. There had to be over 100 soldiers already there. The other two Paltons had arrived. They had just been waiting for this one before beginning their attack.
Ongud, to me, Ashok called.
The Akashani warrior rode up beside him. Ongud was a round-faced and squint-eyed young man who seemed possessed with great enthusiasm.
Yes, General. Have you been here before?
I've only passed through. Those of us from Akashan who joined the Sons are from a vassal house to the south.
It'll have to do. Does this city have warriors stationed in it?
Only a handful to keep order. The main barracks are out of Chakma, a city a few days from here. This is mostly a worker town, only exists because there's a mighty lot of coal here. The number of warriors stationed here might have changed since last year, though. Word is this place hides many of the faithful.
Being infested with rebels was why the warriors had sent 3 full paltons to handle it. Ashok stared at the opposing force on the far side of the valley. Someone of great importance had to be leading it, because they'd erected a rather impressive command tent. Easily 5 times the size of the humble one he'd invaded last night. He could see a commander's flag atop it, but wasn't familiar with the heraldry.
Whose symbol is that?
Ongood squinted.
I'm sorry, General. I can barely see the tent from here, and it's as big as a house. They've got to be a mile away.
The flag is 3 red stars over a green field.
The gods have given you the eyes of a hawk.
The gods have given me nothing. What I have in sight, I lack in patience. Who is it, Nyak?
Sorry. That's the Fonto of the Chakma garrison himself.
A high-status man made a valuable hostage.
Excellent.
He'll be travelling with a reinforced Paltan. Probably 70 or 80 men. Heavy cavalry, lance and bow, all very good on horseback. We destroyed Chakma 3rd Paltan, so the other one will be the 2nd or 4th, horse infantry. Sorry, in the Akashani warrior caste that means they ride to battle, but usually fight on foot. They'll be spearmen more than likely.
Then we'll engage them inside the castless quarter.
Then Ashok grew curious why a lowly junior Nayak would know so much about an entirely different garrison.
What was your obligation?
I wanted to be cavalry, like my father, but there was some suspicion that I was a believer in the Forgotten, which was correct, but...
Spit it out, Ongood. There's no shame in any obligation. Every man has his place.
I was a mere logistics clerk, sir. All I did was keep track of storehouse inventories and supply lines.
Akashan was a vast place, but resource poor. Soldiers can't eat grass, and armies ran on their stomachs. Ongood thought of himself as less because his caste had put him in a position with little chance for glory. Only he knew all about their enemy's most vulnerable systems. The gods hadn't given him superior vision. That had come from the heart of the mountain. But maybe they did give gifts after all.
We'll speak more about this later. Your knowledge is extremely valuable. Try not to die during the coming battle.
Ongood swallowed hard.
Yes, sir.
Their poorer riders had finally caught up. The swamp hunters looked terribly uncomfortable. They were going to hate this next part.
Shekhar, raise the banner.
Being a rather straightforward sort, Ashok wasn't inclined to deception. But that was what he had Somsak for. It had been Shekhar's idea to fly the stolen banner of the Paltan they had just defeated. Their enemy was expecting another force to join them. He'd give them a force, all right.
A cold wind was blowing through the valley. It made strange patterns in the grass.
He waited until he saw a commotion in the other camp. They had been spotted. Surely a Fonto would have someone with a spyglass so they'd be able to make out the banner of the 3rd Paltan.
Sons of the Black Sword!
Ashok raised his voice so all of them could hear him over the wind.
The enemy is under the mistaken impression that we are their reinforcements. The Fonto will expect us to wait for his signal before beginning our attack. Instead, he will see us charge directly into the castless quarter. He will believe that we're trying to steal the honor of striking first and will rush to catch up. Warriors of such status do not like being insulted by upstart Rizzledars.
They'll be running into something a whole lot worse than insults,
Shekhar shouted.
They're expecting castless, not men who've slain a demon, Eklavya said. We'll trounce them so hard that Rizzledar Jagdish will hear about our victory all the way in Vadal and smile with pride. From atop his pile of treasure,
Shekhar finished for him. The men laughed. Despite the odds and their exhaustion, they were in high spirits. That was good. Ashok wasn't used to taking into consideration the morale of others, but he was trying.
"We will be waiting for them. Castler's quarters are packed tight. Dismount. Let your horses run free to add to the confusion. Use the terrain to funnel their superior numbers. Do not attempt to follow me. You will not be able to keep up and you'll only get hurt. Stick to your Havildar. Follow their commands. Archers, on Sheker. Armor, on Eklavya. Try not to fall off until we get there," Sheker told the flustered Toramana. "We will not let you down, warrior," Toramana shouted back. "The gods will keep my ass seated upon this animal, or I am not chief of the wild men. Give no quarter. Break them utterly. Ride, sons."
Ashok kneed his already exhausted mount, but it still leapt forward.
"Ride!"
Down the hill and across the plain, the sons tore toward Dakantar. Soft earth was thrown high by their hooves. Akashani horses were fast and eager to run. As cavalry mounts, they were second only to the massive black beasts of Zargar. Their charge made a sound like thunder. The warriors bellowed their war cries. The workers and hunters just hung on for dear life. Across the valley, the other camp burst into activity. Considering the time of day, their arrival had probably interrupted the Fonto's lunch. As they closed the distance, he could see the enemy soldiers rushing about, grabbing weapons and saddling mounts. They thought they were in a race for bragging rights. They didn't realize they were about to enter a fight for their survival. He nudged his horse straight for the center of Castler's Quarter. The Untouchables must have realized something bad was happening with so many soldiers camped outside because there was no one in the open. Many frightened eyes were peering through doorways or tears in the fabric of their walls. They were all hiding inside so as to not draw the warriors' ire, and they immediately ducked down when they saw Ashok looking their way. As soon as the sons were between the ragged grey homes, Ashok leapt off his still galloping horse, skidded to a stop and bellowed,
"Bring me the overseer of this quarter!"
The sons rode in behind him and dismounted. His Havildars took in the layout of the quarter and then began barking orders. Horses were slapped on the rump and sent running. Depending on how the battle went, there would either be plenty of spare mounts around at the end of this battle to claim, or they wouldn't be needing rides at all. The place smelled like coal and shit. A hushed silence had fallen over the quarter, but in the distance, the workers' district sounded of hammering and steam whistles. They were too industrious to stop their labors just because a small army was camped nearby. Then a horn sounded. The enemy was on the way.
"Come out, overseer! Time is short. We're not here to kill you. We're here to protect you."
A tiny, castless man ran around one of the tents with a long pole in his hand.
"For the Forgotten!"
He went to one knee and pointed the pole toward Ashok. The end of it was capped in metal, and from the way it was wobbling around, it must have been very heavy.
"Are you the overseer here?"
Ashok wasn't sure what the little castless was doing, so he started walking toward him. There was a sharp crack. The puddle next to Ashok's boot suddenly erupted in a geyser. Ashok didn't even need to say the word. Both the Sons of the Black Sword and the Wild Men had fought wizards before. They simply reacted. Several arrows and crossbow bolts flew through the haze of white smoke to pierce the castless. He flopped into the mud with a splash, pierced in several places. As the droplets rained down on him, Ashok thought,
"Fortress magic? Such things were a terrible crime. Its presence also meant the warriors were right, and this place was infested with rebels."
That made Ashok annoyed, and tempted him to leave these fools to their fate.
But he had orders. They might be fools, but they were his fools now.
So he raised his voice loud enough the entire quarter could hear.
"I am Ashok Vadal, you imbeciles! I am here to save your stupid lives. Warriors are coming from the west to kill you. Stay out of my way so I can kill them first.
He heard their panicked whispers as they spoke his castless name. Fall. At times, it seemed like every untouchable in the world knew about him, though in their version, he was one of them who'd taken an ancestor blade and had been raised up by the gods to be their avenger. But once the reality of his words sank in, a multitude sprang from their hiding places and began fleeing in every direction. Ashok drew his sword and started across the quarter. From the sound of the hooves, the warriors were in the process of charging across the valley. In the open, they would have the advantage in mobility and massed archers, but in the cramped and disorderly confines of the castle's quarter, chaos would reign. He shouted at his havildars,
"Let them enter, then engage!"
Shekhar was right behind him. He was grinning from ear to tattooed ear. "Was it like this when you went to fight us in the Jarlang, General?"
"I had an ancestor blade then. Now I have you."
"Not a good trade, that."
"Take the archers. Fall back behind Eklavya's men. Look for targets of opportunity. Hit and run."
"That is what we do best."
The Somsak signaled for his men to follow him as he broke away. The quarter didn't have streets. There were no straight lines in a place like this. The castles either lived in the round felt tents, and these were the soggiest, dirtiest, ragged things he'd ever seen, or they lived in huts made of whatever building materials the workers had thrown out, like cracked mud bricks and discarded sacks. Filthy streams ran through between the homes. Chickens clucked and pigs squealed. Eklavya Karsuan was beside him in the red lamella plate of his house. Every man with him was wearing at least leather and chain, and even the worker caste sons were wearing armor they'd looted from the lost house or the stores of Chatterak. In addition to the swords at their sides and shields on their backs, they were carrying spears, battle axes, or war hammers. And they'd spent the last few months being trained relentlessly by Jagdish and sparring against Ashok. The sons were certainly not the feeble and half-starved opposition the warriors would be expecting. Most of the untouchables were fleeing, but a few of the brave ones were staying in place. They watched the sons march by, and some began to chant, "Fall, fall, fall!" Ashok saw them picking up tools that could be used as weapons, like hay scythes and shovels. Then they got in line, behind the sons. They were wide-eyed, terrified, and out of their element. But the Forgotten's warrior was here. Why wouldn't they fight? How could they lose with the gods on their side? The whole situation made Ashok very uncomfortable, and they'd only just begun to violate the law today. There was a great deal of noise and furor as the Akashani warriors entered the opposite side of the quarter. Ashok could feel the vibration through the ground. In their eagerness to strike first, the heavy cavalry hadn't bothered to dismount. Castlists screamed as they were crushed beneath hooves. Arrogant, they intended to boldly crash right through the whole slum. They would meet here, halfway through the quarter, in terrain which would most favour the sons. Ashok lifted one hand and made a motion for his men to take cover. They immediately complied, ducking into tents or crouching behind crumbling walls. The castless volunteers were too dim to know what the sign meant, so he snapped,
"Hide, fools!"
As the sons spread out and prepared their ambush, they could still hear the angry shouting of warriors and the death cries of the castless. Many would perish because he'd chosen to stop here, but all of them would die if the sons were defeated. Then the warriors of Akashan were upon them. Even deprived of the ability to feel fear, Ashok could fully understand why heavy cavalry was so intimidating to a man on the ground. They shook the world. They used the strongest horses, dressed in barding, which made them look even bigger, and the warriors upon them were armed with lances, which gave them incredible reach. With such an impressive thing thundering toward them, it was no wonder that even the most fanatical gods-inspired rebels turned and ran. And the warriors gave chase, riding right past the hidden and waiting sons. He waited until several of them had gone by.
"Now!"
Ashok roared as he stepped from around a tent and swung his sword at a horse's leg. If he'd still had Mighty Angruvadal, he could have removed all four of the animal's limbs in one blow, but the blade of regular steel merely sheared through flesh and clipped one thick bone. But it was enough for the speeding beast to trip. Horse and rider went down, crashing and sliding into a felt home that crumpled around it. Immediately, Eklavya stepped around the animal's thrashing legs and punched a hole through the downed rider's helmet with the spike on the back of his hammer. Blood squirted from around the cap. Five riders went down fast. The ones behind them realized too late that they should have dropped their lances before entering the tight confines of the castless quarter, when they couldn't turn to meet the sons who were rushing at them from all sides. Horses reared and kicked as their riders were speared or hooked and yanked from the saddle by pole arms. One Akashani stood up in his stirrups and began shouting a warning to the riders behind him, but a wild man's arrow struck him in the mouth.
"Hound them from the quarter, but do not chase them into the open," Ashok ordered Eklavya. "I must go."
Then all he could hope was that Jagdish's lessons had stuck, and his Havildars would know what to do, because in a situation like this, Ashok was far too valuable a weapon to be wasted giving commands. He needed to range ahead, spreading chaos. Ashok picked a narrow path and ran, using the heart of the mountain to give him incredible speed, leaping over debris and cowering castless. He paralleled the path the heavy cavalry had taken. There were more spears and the plumes of helms poking above the shacks to the side, and once he reached a spot where the warrior seemed unafraid and unaware, he vaulted over the roof of a shack, launching himself at the enemy. The first rider never even saw death coming. It was as if Ashok had fallen from the sky, like Ramroan of old. The horse went galloping off, headless body still in the saddle. Ashok hit the muddy ground, rolling, and came right back up to his feet to meet the next surprised warrior. That one tried to ride him down, but Ashok sidestepped, called upon the heart to provide inhuman strength to his limbs, and struck the animal in the head with his fist. The thin metal chanfron designed to protect the horse's face bent around his knuckles. The animal collapsed. The rider was flung down. Ashok stepped over the struggling man and jammed his sword deep into the warrior's back. With a twist, the spine was severed, and another died. He heard dismounted soldiers moving a few alleys over, the metallic clank of weapons, the creak of armor, the splashing of boots in mud, and then the screams as castless were yanked from their pathetic homes. Ashok ducked into the felt tent which separated him from his next victims. It was dim and musty inside. There was a woman and castless children huddled in the corner, terrified that he'd come to massacre them. He knew that look well, because he'd seen many faces like theirs before, thin, dirty, and afraid. Only this time he was here to save them, not destroy them. Before they began pleading for their lives and crying, he whispered,
"I am full."
Then he put his finger to his lips.
"Shh."
The young mother nodded fearfully. The opposite side of the tent lifted as an Akashani warrior stuck his head inside. He glanced over the huddled children dismissively, but when he saw their mother, he grinned and began to move inside.
"Hello, little lamb."
Then he caught sight of Ashok, crouched there, waiting, and before he could cry out, a sword tip was driven through his eye socket and deep into his brain. The only sound he made was a pathetic squeaking noise before Ashok wrenched the steel free and dropped him in an unmoving heap.
"Stay down. It will be over soon,"
he assured the castless family as he moved past the corpse. He slightly parted the felt with his free hand, saw a multitude of warriors rampaging, and picked his next targets.
"Rizaldar!"
A Nekashani warrior approached at a run. Blood was running down his sleeve.
There's resistance ahead!
They're only castless!
A man out of Ashok's sight snapped back.
Just kill them!
The vanguard was ambushed and are being slaughtered! These are real warriors!
Ashok was pleased. The Fonto's heavy cavalry had been prideful. They'd thought they would be able to ride down starving castless with impunity. Instead, they'd found themselves in a twisted maze of shacks where their horses made them clumsy and their height made them easy targets for lurking archers. Before the puzzled officer could formulate new orders, Ashok came out of the tent, swinging.
Chapter 11. The Fonto was confused and displeased.
Give me that!
He snatched the spyglass from Baratas's hand and put it to his eye.
Why are they flailing around like that? What are they doing down there?
It appears our men are retreating, sir.
I can see that, but why? Are they reforming? I told them to push straight through that slum until they came out the other side. Damn that upstart third Palton, stealing my glory.
The Fonto didn't see it yet, but Baratas did. What was happening below wasn't orderly. It wasn't manoeuvring to a superior position. It was a rout. It was death and defeat. The scattering men and riderless horses fleeing the castless quarter were bloody and afraid.
How?
They were fighting fish-eaters. This hadn't even been a mission worthy of warriors. This made no sense. But they were clearly losing. The Fonto's eyes had gone blurry in recent years, so even with the spyglass, it would take him a minute to realize the awful truth, which was a minute they might not have. So Baratas caught the attention of the other bodyguards and then gave them a few silent radar hand signals. They would be prepared to retreat from the camp or counterattack, whatever the Fonto willed once he grasped the situation. He dared not say it aloud, though, because the Fonto was a prideful and angry man, and he didn't like when his subordinates came to conclusions faster than he did. Which was often now, since he'd become doddering in his old age. It was only the command and support staff left in the camp. Most of the warriors had ridden, fast and disorganized, into the quarter at the Fonto's hasty orders. Their illustrious leader himself had stayed behind with his personal bodyguards. Truth be told, their leader should have retired a long time ago, because riding a horse at anything faster than a trot made his back ache for days so badly he could barely walk, so he'd ridden in a cart all the way from Chakma to get here. Which for a warrior of Akashan was downright shameful. But Baratas wasn't of status, and the Fonto was of high status, so nobody cared about one bodyguard's opinion, even if he was one of the most accomplished killers in Akashan.
What is Rizaldar Odgarel doing?
The Fonto muttered.
Why is he riding back here by himself?
Baratas looked at his commander. The spyglass was shaking badly in his thin, bony hands as the old man squinted through it. Then he followed the path of the glass until he saw a lone rider heading their way, galloping hard through the tall grass. The only reason the Fonto's watery eyes had been able to identify Odgaril's horse was because the second Palton's Rizaldar rode a magnificent white stallion, so tall and muscular it stood out from the others. Odgarel came from a high status line, so he had access to the best stables in Akashan.
May I see that, sir?
Baratas risked the Fonto's wrath by reaching for the brass tube, but he had an obligation to protect the old bastard, so he needed to see for himself. It took him a moment to find the rider on the white stallion again, through the narrow, magnified field of view.
Oceans! What is it? Is Odgarel injured?
That's not Odgarel.
What the Fonto hadn't been able to see was that the rider atop Odgarel's stolen horse wasn't wearing the armor of Great House Akashan, but rather a drab worker's coat painted fresh red, and the blood-soaked maniac was heading straight for them.
Shukbatar, Artak, intercept that rider!
The other bodyguards were already atop their horses, so by the time he handed the glass back to the Fonto, they'd begun riding downhill towards the interloper. Each of the Fonto's personal guards was an extremely proficient combatant, chosen for his skill with horse, bow, and sword, so this wouldn't take too long. But just in case, he put one gentle hand on his commander's sleeve. There was almost no meat left beneath the fabric. It was just gristle over bone.
"Perhaps we should go to your cart, Fonto."
"What?" he sputtered. "How dare you? No real warrior would ever flee from non-people. They're starving in rags and don't even have swords. They don't even eat meat, but subsist on wheat gruel and are covered in fleas. And
of course you are right, sir."
Baratas sighed. Since he'd already stood in the old man's proxy in 4 duels since he'd been picked for his obligation, he knew how quickly the Fonto was to declare that offence had been taken.
"However, if you stand atop your cart, the added elevation will give you a better view of the entire battlefield."
"Oh, good idea. Very well, then."
Baratas signalled for the last remaining bodyguard to escort their illustrious leader to his cart and to hitch up the horses. Then he turned back to the crisis below. By the age of 13, Baratas had been considered one of the finest swordsmen in Chakma. By 14, he had survived his first raid into mountainous Dev. By 15, he had earned an award for valour during a raid deep into Karsawan territory. There had been a dozen more medals and ribbons since, and his chest wasn't wide enough to wear them all. He was only 20 now, but already the highest ranked among the Fonto's hand-picked bodyguards, and deadly enough that the older men never questioned his instincts. The Fonto kept picking stupid duels, but Baratas kept winning them, which meant he would be trapped in this obligation until his master died of old age, because the old fool would never retire. Truthfully, he didn't mind the duels, for Baratas was a gifted killer. Right then, his instincts were telling him that something was terribly wrong. As Sukhbatar and Artek closed on the lone maniac charging their camp, they split wide, one going left, the other right, both of them readying their bows. All Akashani horsemen knew how to shoot on the move. Most of them were as familiar with the feel of the animal beneath them as their own legs, so it wasn't even challenging. Mobility and accuracy. That slogan was embroidered on the bottom of the Chakma garrison's flag. The poor suicidal fool coming at them on the stolen stallion didn't even have a bow. With nothing but a sword in one hand, he wouldn't even have a chance. Except Odgarel was a very accomplished combatant, second in the garrison only to Baratas. Which begged the question, how had this maniac gotten a hold of his horse? Akashani bows were short, but made of laminated horn and required great strength to pull, which generated great velocity. Once they closed within 70 yards, Sukhbatar let fly. The rider simply ducked. When Artag launched his arrow, the rider spun his sword and knocked it from the air. Surely that was a fluke. They continued to close the distance. 2 more arrows flew, one right after the other, both aimed at the horse this time, but the rider stood in his saddle, smacked one aside, and then, lightning quick, turned and cleaved the arrow on the other side in 2.
How?
But Baratas quickly overcame his hesitation and shouted in the direction the Fonto had been taken.
Get the commander out of here! Wizard, incoming!
And then he ran for where Kurdan was hitched nearby. While Artek wheeled his mount about and spurred it to run for camp, Sukhbatar drew his sword, let out a mighty battle cry, and charged directly at the rider.
Akashan!
They thundered at each other. Sukhbatar raising his sabre overhead, the intruder leaning way over in the saddle, sword held out to the side like some Zargar trick. The stranger suddenly rose in the stirrups. Blades flashed as the horses passed, less than a foot between them.
They parted. Baratas couldn't tell what happened. But then Sukhbatar's sword arm fell off. His horse reared as its neck was suddenly drenched in hot blood, and it wasn't until Sukhbatar fought to not be thrown from the saddle that he discovered his hand was missing and began to scream. The rider was still coming. Artek turned back in the saddle, drawing his bow to fire at his pursuer, but the rider had closed some of the distance. This time, when the arrow was launched, it was effortlessly struck aside again. But in the same smooth motion, he let the sword fly from his hand. Baratas watched in horror as the sword spun through the air and impaled Artek through the back. That was impossible. His friend seemed surprised to see several inches of steel sticking out of his chest, but then he toppled from the saddle, dead. He landed on his face, the hilt of the sword sticking up from the grass like some manner of burial marker. The rider didn't even slow as he leaned down to snatch the sword from Artag's corpse as he galloped by.
What manner of witchcraft is this?
But Baratas pushed his fear aside, jumped onto his horse, and turned her to meet the demon shaped like a man.
Defend the Fonto!
He shouted to the warriors remaining in camp,
already knowing that since most of them were the political appointments of a vain man, they would be useless in a fight.
If anyone was going to stop this madman, it was him. The rider pulled on the reins, slowing as he entered camp. Though dressed as a common worker, this was obviously no tiller of the soil. He was tall and strong, with a stare sharp enough to cut the grass, cruel as the plains, and covered in fresh blood. He had to be warrior class, and not just born into it, but moulded by its very precepts into something hard as iron. The stranger saw Baratas, a proud and obviously skilled combatant waiting to challenge him, and didn't seem concerned in the least. Instead, he shouted so that all could hear,
"You are already defeated. Blow your horn. Sound your retreat. Save what lives you can."
"Never!"
Baratas bellowed.
"Identify yourself, warrior."
"I am not warrior caste. I am Ashok Vadal."
It was like an icy hand reached into his body, grabbed hold of his stomach, and twisted. Everyone in the world had heard of black-hearted Ashok and his sword that could murder armies. He wouldn't have believed the man was who he claimed to be if he'd not just seen him effortlessly drop two of their house's finest. Baratas suddenly felt cold and ill. Their leader was rolling away in a cart. His command staff didn't know what to do, and none of them showed any inclination to rise to the occasion either. The camp was quiet, except flags whipping in the wind. As his stolen horse danced nervously, Ashok reached up and wiped the blood from his face with one sleeve. But there was too much blood. Vainly smearing it around only made him look even more terrifying.
"Sound the horn, young Akashan. I've killed enough of you for one day. Though your attack has already failed, isolated pockets of your men still fight within the quarter. They will continue butchering castless until they are stopped, and that I cannot allow. The castless are under my protection now."
Baratas didn't know what to do. He'd trained his whole life and fought in many duels and battles. But how did one prepare to fight a legend? His body wanted to run, except surrender was for cowards. And Baratas was warrior caste, where death was preferable to shame. So, he kneed Curdan into a charge.
"Or do not. It is your choice."
Ashok thumped his stirrups against the stallion and clicked his tongue.
"Go."
Across the grass they rode toward each other. Both horses were bouncing, throwing up tufts of soft earth behind them. Baratas knew his steed so well that he steered Curdan with only the gentle pressure of his legs, guiding her toward their target. Once his sabre was in hand, All his fears were forgotten. There was only the movement and the moment. That was why he was the best swordsman in Chakma. Only as they got closer, Bharatas realized something. Ashok was looking through him, as if he wasn't even there. The expression on his face was detached. Bharatas's defiance didn't even rate anger from the former protector. It wasn't that Ashok couldn't see him, but rather that he was just a minor obstacle in pursuit of his goal, like a stump to be ridden around as part of a much longer journey. Bharatas would be dispatched without thought. That unnerved him. And then it offended him. They passed. He struck. Ashok reflexively brushed the attack aside with the flat of his blade, and Bharatas grimaced as Ashok's sword turned into him. He felt the impact through the leather armor over his side, hard enough to lift him in the saddle and nearly hard enough to fling him from Khodan's back. But he hung on, and with one easy hand guided Khodan to wheel about to continue the fight. He stayed calm because that kept Khodan calm. Ashok was turning back as well, but since he was on an unfamiliar and angry horse, was having to wrestle with Odgarel's fierce beast. Fighting on horseback was different than fighting on foot. On the ground, you were in control, but in the saddle, you had to depend on your horse to understand your will. You were partners. Khodan had been Bharatas's primary mount for 2 years now, and they worked well as a team. She sensed his will. He pressed this advantage. Yet, even on an erratically bucking stallion, Ashok was such a good swordsman that it was no advantage at all. Their swords crossed again as the horses circled, trading blows, but dueling the Black Heart proved to be as much the nightmare as the stories made it out to be. Bharatas kept attacking, bringing his saber around in an arc, and then back the other way with the twist of his wrist. But Ashok avoided the steel as if it was nothing. It was only by pure instinct that Bharatas flinched back to not get his throat cut by Ashok's counter. It was so close that the razor edge shaved the hairs from the bottom of his chin. But Khodan bounded away, and there was a small bit of distance between the combatants for a moment.
"You are very skilled."
Ashok seemed mildly surprised that his opponent wasn't dead yet.
"Oh, he has noted me now."
In any other context, having the greatest swordsman in the world give such a compliment would have been a warrior's proudest moment. But right then, Bharatas was simply trying to stay alive. Odgarel's horse had always been an aggressive one. He didn't even seem to care that he'd switched sides, just that he had gotten a chance to fight. He snorted and wheeled about, kicking wildly, bringing Ashok closer. The stallion crashed into Khodan's flank, making the smaller mare stumble. Ashok used that opportunity to knock Bharatas's protective saber down, and in a blur of steel that was too quick to track, the pommel of the Black Heart sword came back up and hit him in the side of the head. It was the worst pain he'd ever felt, like lightning through his cracked skull. The world spun about, sky and grass, and then Bharatas landed hard, bouncing across the dirt. Khodan ran away. Thankfully, both boots had come free of stirrups, or he would have been dragged, a terrible yet common way to die on the plains. All he could hear was a ring, like the vibration of a bell that refused to end. Bharatas tried to rise, but ended up flopping over on his side. Even though he could tell he was on the ground, everything seemed to still be spinning. He put one hand to his temple and discovered that not only had his conical helmet been knocked off, but that his head was leaking blood. There was something dangling from his hair. He tried to pull it off until he realized that the thing he was tugging at was a bit of his scalp come up from his skull, so he mashed it back down. By the time he crawled through enough of the tall grass to see the camp, most of the command staff were already dead, and Ashok was dragging one man by the neck to where the Fonto had left their Paltan's horn. Baratas still couldn't hear, but it was obvious from the puffed lips and crying eyes that the warrior gladly sounded the tones ordering a retreat. He couldn't hear the sounds, but words were exchanged. The surrendered warrior pointed one trembling finger in the direction the Fonto's cart had gone. It was said the Black Heart was without mercy, but he spared the life of the wretch who'd complied with his request, and simply left him there. Ashok climbed back onto Odgaril's horse and rode after the Fonto, either to kill or capture him. Baratas didn't know, and frankly, right then, was in too much pain to care. Barely clinging to consciousness, Baratas crawled deeper into the grass to hide before slipping into the dark. Chapter 12. It only stood to reason that the farther one got from the capital, the fewer inquisitors one would encounter. The foul, masked agents of the Order of Inquisition were uniformly awful people who had terrorized her, intimidated her into breaking the law, hounded her from her home and her beloved capital library, and forced her to live in hiding in the most dreadful of circumstances. Thus, Radamantha Nims Darhaban had been glad when Protector Kano had told her it was time to travel north. Radha believed the reason the Inquisition sought to capture her was so that she could be used as leverage against Lord Protector Devadas, who loved her and planned to marry her once this mess was sorted out. Devadas had kept her in the dark about his plans, for her own safety, of course. But she knew whatever vile plots the Inquisitors were up to would result in no good. She'd been snuck out of the capital months ago, hidden at an awful, stinking goat farm, and narrowly avoided being captured by bounty hunters only because Devadas had dispatched mighty Kano to watch over her. She couldn't even begin to speculate how much harder they would search for her once they learned that she had in her possession something else that the Inquisition dearly wanted, an ancient artifact of black steel. Senior historian Vikram Akarshan had told her the thing was called Asura's Mirror, but it filled her with such a general sense of unease that she had trouble thinking of it as anything other than the thing. Black steel was the most potent magical substance in the world. Weapons forged from it could obliterate armies and cleave demons in half. Tiny fragments of black enabled wizards to do terrible and seemingly impossible things. And the material it was made out of wasn't even why she was apprehensive about the thing, but rather what it did. Its original mission, no one knew, but in the one brief demonstration she'd had of its power, she'd seen that something lived inside it. Intellectually, Radha knew that wasn't quite true. It wasn't a cage, more of a window or a portal or some such thing, but to where or who or what or how, she knew not. She'd never read about anything like this in the library. And if that wasn't bad enough, when Protector Kano had found out Vikram Akarshan had given her the thing, he'd warned her to keep it well hidden, because if word got out that she had in her possession an item of such value, there would be no shortage of thieves who'd gladly murder them both for it. So here she was, skulking toward Apura with a mysterious black steel device stuffed into a satchel slung over her shoulder, hiding from inquisitors and robbers and bounty hunters, and who knew what else. This was all Vikram's fault. The crafty old man was the one obligated to care for the cursed relic, not her. She was a valuable archivist, not some overrated historian. To the oceans with that entire stuck-up order. But Radha couldn't be too angry at him. The Inquisition was looking for Vikram, too. They wanted to secure the mirror for themselves for some unknown, yet surely nefarious reason. Since their two rival orders were about as friendly as the Cobra and the Mongoose, the Inquisitors would never expect someone from the museum to entrust one of their artifacts to someone from the library. Originally, Vikram had asked her to take on his obligation should he be killed. But when he had been informed by his astronomer friends that a great force of angry Inquisitors and their drafted warriors had shown up at the observatory demanding Vikram's whereabouts, he had rethought his original plan. Vikram and his family had fled one way, and she and Karno had gone the other. Karno had offered them his protection, but the historian had said that he had other plans which he would not divulge. "I've never been to a Pora before, Karno."
"No offence intended, librarian, but I assumed that you've not been many places besides the capital."
Radha sniffed, but it was in fact a fair assessment. Her father was the head of her order. Her family seldom had a reason to leave the confines of the finest city in the world. She'd never wanted to live a life of adventure, and would have been content to stay in the library the rest of her days. Karno Uttara was slightly ahead of her, astride a truly gigantic horse. It looked like a pony beneath him because Karno was quite possibly the biggest man she'd ever known. Not fat, though, not in the least. Karno was made of meat so solid he was more like a bull than a man. It seemed to her that he'd have been better off riding around on an elephant than a horse. But when she'd suggested an elephant to be a suitably impressive mount for the protector, he had laughed aloud and told her that her book learning did not always translate so well to the logistical issues of the real world. This had caused Radha's cheeks to flush, but she'd held her tongue because, yes, she had in fact once read a library book about the care and maintenance of elephants, so should have known better.
"Apura is a busy place," Karno told her. "Too many eyes for my taste. I don't intend to enter the city itself. Tonight we will camp. Tomorrow we will skirt around the edge, avoiding checkpoints, and then take one of the trade roads north."
It was illegal to cross Great House borders without getting your travelling papers stamped. But Karno had already done similar sneaky things to get them out of the Zargar Desert and into the hill country of Thau. As a protector, all he had to do was flash the symbol of his office, the fanged and leering face of the law, and he could go wherever he wanted. But people inevitably talked about encountering one of the rare protectors, and word would surely get back to the Inquisitors.
"Though I understand the need and agree with your caution, I'd been hoping we'd be able to stop in civilization and eat a meal not killed by you immediately before. A real bath would be wonderful. I smell worse than my horse. I've not slept in an actual bed since we left Vikram's estate."
"Sleeping on the ground builds character," Karno said.
"It builds backaches and tick bites."
As a daughter of the first caste, Radha had lived a life of comfort. The last few months had been painfully educational. She was actually rather proud of how many indignities she'd bore on this journey without complaint. She tried especially hard never to whine since Karno was so taciturn and stoic. But Apura was right over there. There were still too many trees in the way to see it yet, but she could hear the faintest sounds of civilization echoing through the hills. In fact, it sounded like... Could it be?
"Karno, is that music?"
She didn't know how, and neither Karno nor Devadas would ever share their order's secrets, but somehow a protector's hearing, sight, and sense of smell were supernaturally good at times. Karno lifted his shaggy head for a moment, and then nodded.
"Yes, you're probably only hearing the drums, but a great many bands are playing. There are hundreds of voices in song, probably in the streets from the echoes."
He looked back at her.
"I had forgotten today's date."
"It's holy,"
Radha exclaimed. She had been riding across the miserable desert and then the chilly hills for so long that
that she'd not even realized the new year was upon them. Holy Day was the biggest celebration in Lok. The law granted every member of the three castes 2 days away from their obligated labours, one to prepare and one to enjoy. Every great house celebrated it differently, but it was always a colourful festival of feasting and dancing. Even Radha, who was normally very uncomfortable in the company of people, enjoyed Holi. However, the part she found most appealing right then was the mandatory hospitality, which meant there would be wonderful food everywhere, and she'd be able to finally eat something other than whatever poor animal Karno had managed to brain by throwing his hammer at that day. "Karno, think of the food. We must go into Apura." Karno nodded toward their pack horse, where a dead rabbit hung.
"We have sufficient for tonight."
If she ate one more stringy, unseasoned hare, she would simply die.
"There will be cakes."
"It would not be prudent."
"There will be sweet yogurt."
But she knew already she was trying to tempt the untemptable. Karno just frowned at her.
Or she assumed he frowned.
His beard was so bushy after weeks without care that she could only assume the expression by the further squint of his already narrow eyes.
Radha sighed.
She'd always thought of herself as an unsociable and untalkative person, but she didn't hold a candle to Karno. Over the last month, she could count their not immediately pertinent discussions on the fingers of one hand. In the rare times he actually engaged in idle conversation, she learned that Karno himself was a straightforward creature of pragmatism and duty. Devadas, his lord, her lover, had commanded Karno to keep Radha safe, so that was what he was going to do, no matter how terribly uncomfortable it might be. They rode for a while down the trade road. She'd wondered why they'd seen so few other travellers all day, but it made sense now. They were all celebrating the new year. As their horses plodded along, a vast lake came into view. This had to be the infamous Red Lake, which she'd read about in the history books. A great battle had once taken place upon these shores, and the lake had turned red from all the blood. She'd not realized just how much blood that indicated until she saw the real thing. Despite the grim name, it was never-ending blue, with brown mountains capped in white rising up all around it. The sight of so much water frightened her.
"It is like the ocean."
Karno chuckled. "It is nothing like the ocean. There hasn't been a demon this deep into the interior in a very long time. Allow the animals to drink and let's fill our canteens." Of course, Karno would be jaded. He was from a peninsula surrounded on three sides by hell, and it was his order's job to fight demons. Radha was from the capital, which had been built as far from the corrupting sea as possible. All of the capital's water came from mighty aqueducts. This was the biggest body of water she'd ever seen. As an educated woman, she knew that water was just an element, not the embodiment of evil, as believed by those who followed an extremely literal interpretation of the law. It wasn't water's fault demons lived in it. Still, she was so nervous that even her horse could tell, and the mare paused, hesitant to continue.
"It's fine, girl," Radha told her,
even though she herself couldn't shake the feeling of unease which had come upon her. She dismounted, something she'd become exceedingly skilled at in recent weeks, and led her down the sandy bank. Despite her assurance to her steed, Radha still let her horse drink first, just in case a demon came exploding out of the depths. Because the sun was setting, the reflection on the rippling surface made it so that she couldn't see the bottom more than a few feet away. Yet no giant sea demons leapt out to consume them. Radha knelt down and filled her canteen. It was then that she realized she could see buildings farther down the shore. The outskirts of Apura were less than a mile away. Kano knelt next to her, scooped up the icy melt, and drank from his cupped hands. He also saw what she was looking at. Kano may have been a stern man, but beneath that, he was not an unkind one.
"I know these months have been difficult for you, Rada. If it were up to me, I would take the fight to the corrupt inquisitors and end this once and for all."
"Only Devadas asked you not to."
Now it was Karno's turn to sigh. "I know not why. I've no head for the political games, but Devadas is my commander, so I obey. And he is my friend, so I trust him. He asked me to keep you safe, so I will. If it were not for this oath, I would go into Apura and bring you back a sack full of treats."
"I know, Kano. You keep me miserable, but only out of a sense of duty, like a kindly prison guard."
He chuckled. "Thank you."
While the animals drank with great gulping, sucking noises, Kano sat on a nearby rock. Even though they were close to the shore, and it was nearly sundown, Rada was glad to sit for a moment. She'd read books about horsemanship, but books were insufficient to teach you just how sore riding made your legs and buttocks. Large insects buzzed over the surface of the water. Kano must have decided the moment called for one of his rare conversations, because very surprisingly he said,
"You know, I believe Devadas loves you very much."
It was not like Kano to speak of frivolous things like love. She thought Devadas truly did, but it was nice to hear it confirmed from an impartial witness. "As I love him."
"I told him it was foolish. Do not make that face at me, librarian. It is not an insult to you. It was an insult to him. He let love get in the way of his obligation, which is why we suffer now. We are not supposed to become emotionally attached to those we protect, for good reason. Yet, he is a man with few flaws. If a man must have flaws, I suppose loving a beautiful woman is a most understandable one."
Rada blushed. "I see once again why they call you Blunt Kano." But then she was curious. "You said few. What do you think his other flaws are?"
It is not my place to say."
"Kano, please. Once he retires from his obligation, we plan to marry. If he's a secret monster, I'd rather know now."
Not that she would believe Kano if he told her that anyway.
Her experience with the opposite sex wasn't exactly exhaustive, but she'd found nothing in Devadas's character to suggest that he was low or mean.
"Nothing of that sort. He will surely treat you kindly. Like most of us, he is only cruel toward those who break the law, and that's not because he enjoys it, but because it is required." Kano cleared his throat and spit on the ground. "No, Devadas's problem is that he's ambitious. He tries to hide it, but Devadas has a desire for achievement that is rare, even among great men."
"Why? That's not a bad thing at all."
"Determination itself is not. Young Devadas lost everything. His house, his family, the ancestor blade which he believed would eventually be his, broken, and his father, driven mad from shame, hurled himself off a cliff into the sea. Devadas's only inheritance was a bad reputation. No house wanted a child of bad omen, so he was given to the protectors, where he worked his way to the rank of master. A rare achievement indeed."
"Then his ambition is a good thing."
"The law says every man has his place for a reason. On a fundamental level, Devadas is unable to accept this. By his nature,
He will never be content with his current station, no matter how vital it is, but instead will always be looking for more. That is how he earned his scar. Kano ran one finger across his face.
Devadas was cut by the black steel blade of Ashok Vidal. There is no shame in losing a duel to an ancestor blade, Radha said reflexively, trying to defend her man's honor.
Of course not. Shame comes not from losing that duel, but from the desire which caused it. I was there. A new obligation, only a boy, but I watched that fight. That prideful, pointless, inevitable duel. Ambition can make a man great. It can even make him the Lord Protector. But too much ambition blinds a man to dark paths. Kana trailed off.
Enough. I will speak no more ill of my superior. We are all imperfect somehow, especially me. Despite his flaws, Devadas is one of the two best men I have ever known.
The second? Radha was afraid she already knew the answer, and that the man she loved was hunting him now.
Ashok Vidal. Though such a statement of fact is not a popular one to make nowadays, it remains true. He saved my life many times. But I misspoke. Ashok is no man.
Of course not. He's a castless criminal.
No. Ashok is a force of nature. He was the law made flesh and bone. We all aspire to be like him, and any protector who claims otherwise now is lying. What Ashok has become, I don't know. The only thing I do know with a grim certainty is that Devadas will find him and kill him.
Good, Radha snapped.
Perhaps.
The two of them were silent for a long time as the sky turned orange, the lake glowed, and the music of the New Year celebration drifted across the water. In a way, the view was calming. It was nearly enough to make her not fear the water. Kano changed the subject to lighter fare.
Before I was obligated to the order, back in Utara, unholy, my mother would make sweet milk balls.
How do you make a ball of milk?
You fry it. I mean, it's like cheese, but golden and covered in syrup.
Very good.
Protectors are not supposed to serve in their homeland, to prevent bias in our judgment, so I've not had one in a long time. 18 years I've been a protector, but I can still remember that taste. Or at least, I imagine I do. Should I ever return, I wonder if the real thing would live up to the memories.
Since she'd never before heard Kano sound nostalgic, Radha decided to try swaying him again.
You know, you might be a foot taller than everyone in Apura, but I'm not. I'm so dirty they'd think I'm the poorest worker. If anyone asks, I'll say I'm a farmer of goats. I'm practically an expert on that subject now. With all the strangers sure to be in town for the parties, I could sneak in and... He held up one big hand.
I will save us both time and stop you there.
Kano abruptly stood, his weekly allowance for idle conversation used up.
Come. I remember a good place nearby to set up camp.
They led their horses away from the lake, which made Radha breathe a little easier, and up the hillside toward the trade road. Unexpectedly, Kano stopped.
There's eyes upon us.
Radha looked around. The shadows were deepening. There were 1,000 places someone could be hiding behind trees or rocks.
Where?
Kano didn't answer the question. Instead, he took his warhammer from where it hung on his saddle and placed it over one broad shoulder.
Radha, get on your horse.
What? Do as I say.
She got her foot in the stirrup and climbed up, noticing, as she did, that her horse was being oddly skittish all of a sudden. The mare had sensed something as well.
Be silent. Follow my orders without question.
Carno never got upset. His voice remained calm, yet for the first time since she'd met the fearsome man, she detected an unfamiliar emotion. This was a hero who'd taken on assassins armed only with an armful of books, who she'd seen fell a Zarga warhorse with a casual hammer toss. What in the world would make Carno afraid?
If I tell you to ride, ride as hard as you can into Apura, then dismount and try to disappear among the crowd. Find a place to hide until I come for you. Do you understand?
Radha nodded vigorously. Any unseen thing that made Carno nervous was enough to leave her utterly terrified. Carno then walked, with purpose, up the road, and planted himself in the middle, staring at a particularly dark thicket of trees and bushes. She couldn't tell what he was looking at.
There. A high branch shook as something leapt soundlessly down from it. No man could have climbed that high unseen or dropped without breaking their legs. What was stalking them?
To worry Carno so, maybe it was a demon? Only the lake was to their backs. Were they standing between a demon and its home?
Radha held onto the reins with both hands, knuckles white, ready to jab her heels into the flanks.
But it was no demon that strolled confidently out of the bushes, but rather a tiger.
Radha had seen a tiger before. There was a zoo within the capital, which held many animals from all over Lok for the amusement of her caste. Only those had been sickly and weak compared to this sleek beast. Books had told her that tigers were common in Gujara and Volkan, and scarce everywhere else. But reading about a wild tiger or seeing one while separated by iron bars was nothing like facing one 100 feet away. The tiger made no sound whatsoever. Paws padded across rocks and sticks without so much as a whisper. It was so silent that Radha wondered why it had showed itself at all. She'd read that they were ambush predators. If it meant them harm, why not wait until they were on the road and then jump down on them from a branch? Its actions made no sense. As their horses whined and stamped, Carno took his warhammer from his shoulder and laid it across both hands.
"Greetings," the protector said, as if he were speaking to a man rather than a great cat.
The cat stopped 50 feet from Carno and stood there, looking at him, its manner so incongruous that Radha thought perhaps she'd lost her mind. She expected it to leap at him. Only then there was a terrible blurring, a black sear that made her blink and shield her eyes, and when she looked again, the tiger was gone, and there stood a man. He was of average height, of dark complexion, clean-shaven except for a moustache and narrow goatee, dressed in the baggy clothing preferred in the Zargar Desert, and he wore a curved sword on his belt. All Radha really knew about wizards was that they scared her to death.
"Hello, travellers," the stranger said, cold but cordial. "Merry Holi."
"Merry Holi to you as well," Carno replied, not seeming the least astounded at seeing a tiger turn into a man. "Inquisitor."
"Witch hunter," the stranger corrected him.
Radha had to stifle a cry as he identified himself, for the witch hunters were the near-mythical elite of the Order of Inquisition. She'd heard rumours of them, everyone in the capital had, but never read anything about them, because every reference to that secretive group had been long since scrubbed from the capital library.
"Identify yourself, travellers," the witch hunter demanded.
"I am but a humble man of the worker caste, journeying with my wife to Apura for the festival."
Blunt Carno was a terrible liar.
"A humble worker, eh?
Which is why you do not quail before the tiger form, And why you stand there with a war hammer, overly confident.
Workers have hammers too. They're remarkably versatile tools. How may I help you, Witch Hunter?
Leave the false identities to my order, Protector. Lies do not suit you. Karno's silver inlaid armor was hidden in the bags on their pack horse, and the token of his office was on a chain hidden beneath his shirt, but there was no use denying his identity.
Very well. How may I help you, Witch Hunter?
I am Koja. I seek a fugitive. A woman. He gave Rada a sly look as he said that.
And I am Protector of the Law, 18-year senior, Karno Utara, and you should move along, for I have no fugitive here.
Radamantha Nems Darhaban has been summoned to the Inquisitor's Dome. It would be a grave violation of the law for her to ignore such a thing. Even the protectors must honor the summons of the Inquisition. The Inquisitor took another step forward. Karno tightened his grip around the well-worn shaft of the warhammer, fingers so strong his calloused skin made an audible creak like leather. The Inquisitor paused. These are perilous times for your order, Karno Utara. You are not currently favored in the capital, as we are. Ashok Vidal has shamed you all. The judges doubt your loyalty. Should you stand against my lawful summons, word will get back to the capital. You may be doing great and irreparable damage to your order. Think carefully on this, Protector.
I was just telling my friend here how I have no head for politics.
You are making a grave mistake.
Karno grunted. This would not be my first. Now do your little tiger trick and scurry off. I tire of your threats.
Forgive my over-familiarity. I've been tracking you for weeks, so I feel as if I know you. The witch hunter spread his arms, a mockery of an apology. When I was given this assignment, I was warned that Karno Utara was an unsubtle brute, but second in ferocity only to the Black Heart, which is why I brought a few of my brothers along to help.
Salt water, Karno muttered, as something orange and white slunk through the brush to their side.
Your reputation is also why I used up a precious fragment of black steel to muffle the approach of our inquisitors and the 50 warriors we drafted to aid us in Zaga.
The witch hunter snapped his fingers. The change was abrupt. Even Rada's normal human ear could suddenly hear the sound of hoofbeats out of sight around the bend, but closing fast.
It must have sounded like thunder to Karno's ear. Ride, Rada! Karno bellowed. Go!
Her horse had leapt forward before she'd even had a chance to thump it, and she took off down the road. All Rada could do was hang on.
Get the librarian!
The witch hunter shouted. Seemingly, out of nowhere, there was a flash of orange ahead of her. Another tiger! The mare stuttered to a halt, reared back and screamed, and Rada screamed as she was nearly thrown from the saddle. The tiger slunk toward her, eyes glowing with a greenish-black light, teeth bared. It leapt,